Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. Today is Garden Guy Day with Gary Heilig, your host Tom Mazur and Sue Mazur. Welcome, Gary.
Happy to be here. Weather's great outside still.
All right. And Sue's calling us from Kalamazoo. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you. I agree with Gary. It's great out, and I'm looking forward to the quiz.
I am too. Sue, would you lead us in a word of prayer?
Sure. Heavenly Father, thank you for this beautiful day that you've sent us and the beautiful things that we so enjoy in the summer, not only in our gardens, but out in nature and the things that you've created and the things that we are there to learn so we can learn more about you and worship you as our creator. So help us to learn more about that in this program today. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Gary, we're turning it over to you.
Okay, I think you'll get the theme after the first question. And it is, what vegetable was used by the Incas of Peru and brought to Europe by the Spanish in the mid-1500s?
You know, my first guess, which I now know is wrong, but I was going to say maize, but I believe the answer is potatoes.
And you would be correct. And also, there's a little bit of an argument here, but they're believed to have originally been found around Peru. But there's another country that kind of claims that potatoes were around there, too. Do you know what country that was?
That one I do not know. I'll defer to my sister, Sue.
Well, let's see. Since it's in the Andean Mountains kind of chain, let's see. Maybe something like Chile or Bolivia or something like that.
It's Chile. Yep.
They must have some common culture or something.
Geography and so on.
Yeah, they have a little rivalry on that one. But now, second question is, where do potatoes fall in the worldwide list of most important crop list?
Now, I'm thinking about this. I'm sure rice is in that category, right?
That's number one.
Okay.
And I think corn is second.
No, actually, corn is third.
Is it third? Okay, well, wheat then.
Wheat is second.
And let's put potatoes fourth.
It was fourth, yeah.
That's right. It's fourth among overall crops, but it's number one among the non-grains because, of course, rice and wheat and all those sorts of things are grains.
Well, I kind of feel like that was a group effort here to get those answers.
Yeah. And the next one is, how many species of potatoes are known to exist?
Well,
I think I know this one, I think.
But let me say something first, dear sister. The I was in a bookstore once upon a time, and they had this book was called The Vegetable Bible. And it had the various foods, vegetables. And I turned to the potato section, and I was just plain blown away. The black potatoes, which are almost black. We throw out black potatoes around here. But anyway, I mean, the difference, I was just totally, it was a pictorial book with, of course, a lot of descriptions. But, and I think I bought that for my wife, and I think it's in our library. But it is quite amazing. I'm going to say there's 50 varieties, but I will defer to my sister for the correct answer.
What do you think, sir?
I'm afraid he's fallen far short because I know there's something like between 800 or 1,000 or something like that varieties of potatoes.
That's really excessive. The information that I found said about 150, and only about 100 of them were edible. But I'll go back and check to make sure. But that's what I found.
I was watching some program and they were talking about the potatoes and how they preserved them. You know, showed them like up in the the people that speak Quechua up there up in the Andes Mountains, and how they, because they had all these, you know, so many varieties of potatoes, and well, how they would preserve them because they would make them last for years without refrigeration up there.
Remember, the question was how many species, not varieties.
Oh, I'm thinking varieties.
Yeah, because a variety or a cultivar, for instance, if you said apples, there are over 5,000 known varieties, but in terms of species, it's a lot smaller.
Because, oh, I see.
For instance, you have the edible apple, which, if I remember correctly, was Malus domestica or something like that. But then you have crab apples and different things like that.
Well, well, so, listeners, just remember, you learned that here.
Okay, here's a thought question. If you faced starvation and could only consume two foods, what would they be and why?
Well,
Tom, let me guess this one.
Oh, okay.
I think, this is my guess, I think they would be two of Cleanie's, Brenda's favorite foods, and that would be potato and kale.
Well, the potato should have been a gimme, because that's the theme of our quiz.
I was going to say rice, but...
Well,
I was going to say potato and kale. Brenda really loves those, and yes, kale has all those added things, those superfood.
The problem with that is you don't get any vitamin D from kale. No vegetable contains vitamin D, so you have to have something that has vitamin D in it.
Can't you sit in the sun while you're eating them?
Yeah, well, actually, it's a dairy product like milk, because it not only gives you fat, vitamin D, some protein. And although it's not a perfect diet, people can survive on that. So it's not kale.
Ah, here I thought you could just sit in the sun and eat it.
So do you have the answer, Gary?
Yeah, potatoes and milk.
Okay, gotcha. Gotcha, okay.
What European country was the first to try to grow potatoes? And they had difficulty doing it.
I'm just going to throw out the Spaniards, because they were all over the place, especially in South America.
It was the Spaniards. But do you know why they had problems growing the potatoes?
Because there were all those rumors about it, like tomatoes, you know, like they were poisonous and bewitched and evil and stuff like that.
Well, all of that, when they were talking about tomatoes, was about eating it. But they were having problems growing it.
They tried to grow it above ground. I don't know.
No, when you think about where they were, where potatoes were originally growing, they were in an area where they had about 12 hours of sunlight on a regular basis. But when they came to Europe, the lighting was a little different. And by the time the potatoes started to set tubers, it was getting too cold in the fall.
Mm.
So they weren't able to grow them successfully. And it took some time, but what farmers did is they started selecting plants that had enough genetic diversity where they would set their tubers a little early. And then over about 100 years, they started selecting and selective breeding, and then they got potatoes that would grow in other places. And guess what European country where they grew really well?
Ireland.
Ireland was a great place because, and one of the reasons why they grew very well there is it was cooler, and in the fall, they didn't get the frost, and so they could still produce potatoes there, even though the lighting wasn't perfect, but they had a longer growing season without frost.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, there's an interesting story. I think I saw this one on PBS or something, but it was kind of cool. It's a story that this early scientist there discovered that potatoes were, you know, nutritionally, they were cheap to grow, and they were really, they'd be really good food for the poor. And then France had been having all these wars all the time, so everybody was hungry, you know, because of that. So he convinced the king that this would be a great food, not only to feed the people, but easy to take on the march for the armies because they were still fighting. So the king said, great, but the people were all suspicious and they didn't want to try it and they didn't want to eat it. And it was kind of a flop until the scientists convinced the king to pull a trick on the people. And so they planted 100 acres of potatoes, and then they detailed these army units to guard the fields day and night, marching around, keeping people out. Well, all the poor people who had been suspicious before suddenly got interested, and they're like, hey, what are they hiding from us? What are they getting that we're not getting? And that changed their attitude, so they started growing the potatoes and then discovered that they were really yummy. Well, nutritious.
Yeah, they were very nutritious from the standpoint that they had protein, vitamins, minerals, and they found out it was such an easy crop to grow that the peasants made it a staple, especially in Ireland. And also, you could grow potatoes below the ground, and if you were growing, say, something like wheat above the ground, which wasn't as nutritious, it could be easily taxed because they can come through and see it.
But since
the potatoes were growing below the ground, people would only harvest a few at a time. They would never harvest all their potatoes, and so they were able to avoid taxes. But also many leaders throughout Europe found out that it was such a good food, and if you had somebody attack your country, and one of the things they would do when they're marauding through is they take everybody's food, but potatoes were usually missed because they were below ground. So
they'd have to dig them up.
One of the things that they would do in the European countries, if war was coming, they would start increasing their potato production.
I thought you were going to say the way they introduced it to the public was as they made them French fries.
Well, we're not going to talk much about French fries because that's one of my weak spots. Okay, who do you think are the top five potato producing countries?
Oh, China's always in there somewhere.
Actually, China's number one with 94,362,175 metric tons. Who do you think is second?
Hungry people. India?
India, right, yeah. And the Indians really picked up on potatoes because naturally they didn't start there. Because when the potato was brought back to Europe from South America, it had not gotten to the United States yet. And when the colonists came over, they brought potatoes to what's now the United States. Okay, guess who number three is? They're currently at war.
Oh, Ukraine?
Ukraine, that's right. And then the USA is fourth. Then the Russian Federation is fifth in world potato production. And I just wonder how production is doing with this war between the two, because there's a lot of mine laying in the fields, and farmers don't like to farm when there's mines in the field.
That's a terrible idea.
This is one that you're not going to guess, because I was clueless on this one. Who eats the most potatoes per capita? Which means if you're looking at individual countries, the people eat the most potatoes.
Well, I don't think they eat a lot of potatoes in China. At least it seems like it's more like about the rice thing there.
They do. Eat potatoes, but it's not China. And I'll give you a hint. The country starts with a B.
Bulgaria.
It's one of those like former Soviet satellite countries, because they eat all those cabbages and turnips and potatoes and things there.
It's Belarus.
And it was a satellite country there.
Yeah, their amount is 170 kilograms per person, followed by Ukraine and then Kazakhstan. They eat the most potatoes on the planet. And, of course, a kilogram is about 2.2 pounds. So multiply times two, that's a lot of potatoes.
It is.
But, you know, potatoes are great because they have the nutrients, and they're also filling.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many ways you can make them. So, okay, this is a botany question. What part of the plant, and you should know this one, is the potato tuber?
It's like the stem thing.
That's right. It's stem. And the reason why we know it's stem, even though it grows below ground, is because if it's exposed to light, they'll turn green, mm-hmm. which means it goes through the process of photosynthesis. But in the in that process, they also produce an alkaloid poison that if you eat too much of it, it'll make you sick. You'd have to eat an awful lot for it to kill you, but most people can't do that. All right, so let's try the next one. Who are the top five U.S. producing states of potatoes?
Well, I'm going to say Idaho.
Well, yeah, that's the gimme. Idaho, yeah. Who do you think is second?
I'm going to say Wisconsin.
They're third.
Or Washington.
Washington State. That's right. That's their second.
Michigan's okay, we still need not too bad.
Maybe Oregon.
Oregon's number four. Michigan's not in there.
Oh, my. But I know.
We have nice white potatoes. I don't know why we're not up there, but let's see. Who else? Oregon, well, Washington, Ohio.
Michigan is a very diverse state, but we just don't produce enough compared to these other states. It's northwestern or northern and mid country.
Nebraska.
Oh, North Dakota, because they're next door to Idaho.
That's right, North Dakota. Okay, this one might be a little tough for you. During the Irish potato famine between the years 1845 and 1849, what percentage of the population of Ireland either died from the famine or left the country? What percentage?
50%.
Right on the money.
Yep.
Half. That's a lot of folk.
Yep.
That's a major population drain. All right, let's see if you get this one, Sue. What field of study was created as a result of the famine?
Botany. I want to say it's like an agricultural something because they didn't want it to happen again. They couldn't afford to have it happen again.
You're in the right direction.
So an agricultural development something.
Tuberology.
Tuberology. Are you ready?
No. How about some sort of fungi, antifungal something?
Plant pathology.
There you go.
Oh,
you
plant
were close.
Pathology. Right,
pathology. That's yeah, that's the study of the diseases. Okay. Maybe you'll get this one. Maybe not. How did NASA make the potato even more special than it already is?
It grew in space.
I heard about this. They developed a way to make a super seed, quantum seed potatoes or something up there.
Well, it was the first vegetable grown in outer space.
There you go.
Now, I don't know if it was it was 1995, so it probably had to be Skylab. That's my guess. I didn't look that up.
Well,
it's kind of a cool idea, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
If you're wanting to have long-term presence in space, providing food is probably one of those key things because shooting it up there is kind of expensive.
Yeah, it gave me an idea for a future topic. We'll talk about food production in space.
Okay.
And talk about some of the research they've done and some of those issues. So
that's the
quiz for today.
Well, folks.
That was fun.
Yes, we did enjoy that. So we'll be back after this break, and we'll talk about September crops and organic pesticides. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, and we've got a smile in our voice. This is your host, Tom Majure, with Sue Majure and Gary Heilig. We are talking about September. Gary, kind of give us an agriculture report, both on the garden front and general agriculture.
Well, in home gardens, it's been dry in certain areas, but it really depends on where you are in the state as to what you've been experiencing. I live in the Lansing area, and we did have a dry period where lawns, for instance, went dormant, but they didn't die. And if you're able to water, then you should be fine. Now, if you are, say, a Christmas tree farmer and you're on a light sandy soil and you had no way to water your plants, you might have lost a certain percentage of them. But for the most part, it's been a pretty good year. The temperatures weren't bad. Our humidity, if we had high humidity days, it wasn't for very long. So I'm very happy with this summer. Of course, I can water easily, too. So I have irrigation systems out.
It has been pretty dry in Kalamazoo because Tom would say, yep, we got some rain up here. And I'm like, still no rain here. And it was like that for like 8 weeks. We didn't have rain. And then we have gotten some rain now and then, but it's just been like for a few hours. And we haven't had like a good all day long soaker that we needed. And we just, it's been kind of on the edge.
Well, when you, for instance, when you have really warm weather, things like melons like it, especially watermelon, because they need a lot of hot weather in order for them to ripen. You tend to have peppers. If you don't water them, they'll be hotter. And for me, that's not a problem. Or with lettuce or cucumbers, if they don't get enough water, they'll be a little bit more bitter in their taste. So there are some things that are on the downside. But overall, I'd rather have a warmer summer, a little less rain, because I can add water. And so I can decide on how much moisture I get, as opposed to when you're constantly getting rain, you have a higher disease pressure, you have more root diseases. Plants don't do very well when you're just getting a lot of rain. And you think about what happened in California in August, for instance, they just got washed out.
Literally.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and China. Oh, my goodness. China's wiped out. A lot of their crops are in trouble.
Well, we just recently had a corn roast here at Strong Tower Radio, and went out there and got the corn from the farmer, and he said it was a little bit behind. But he, you know, we were a regular customer, and he took care of us, but he didn't have any corn out on his fresh sweet corn stand.
Yeah, the corn will slow down a little bit because corn is a rapid growing plant, and if they don't have what they need, then they just don't grow as fast. But like I said, when you have a big agricultural enterprise and you can't irrigate, then you're subject to whatever nature gives you.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about harvesting. September is one of the last warm harvest months. What will we be looking at this month?
Everything. I mean, apples are starting to come out. There's the prime apple harvesting season going into October. People are harvesting their pears. If you have peaches like Georgia Bell, they're usually ready in September. Blueberries, the late ripening varieties are ready at that time. If you have ever-bearing raspberries, you're going to be getting those. Just about every vegetable in your garden will be ready. So the thing is, if you're not ready to do your canning and freezing, you're going to lose stuff. And, of course, you'll have your little visitors. The raccoons will stop by, and deer will come by and bite on your melons and squash if you don't have some protection. Every evening I have a deer and her doe. They decide to come and eat pears off the ground. And when they're finished with those, they work on the tree. So, you know, that's the way it goes. So just about everything is being harvested right now.
What are you hearing about our apple crop this year?
Well, as I've passed orchards, I don't seem to have a problem. I was looking at Uncle John's cider mill on the way up, and their trees were just loaded with apples. So, again, it's going to depend on where you are in the state and how your production has been. In a year like this, apple trees, they're, especially if you have what we call semi-dwarf and standard trees, they have the ability to get the moisture out of the ground. So they shouldn't have much trouble. The ones that are going to have a little bit more trouble if they're not irrigated are some on the most dwarfing rootstocks, which have very shallow root systems. And so you might notice that if you didn't thin, you'll have a smaller apple individual fruit. But from what I've seen, people have apples, and I have apples in my yard. So
actually, this happens to be the year that one of our oldest trees, probably 80 to 100 years old, is got plenty of fruit on it. And it doesn't always, not only every other year, but sometimes it takes a year or two off. Tell us about, I'm curious about, there's a variety called translucent apples. Are you familiar?
Transparent.
Transparent, mm-hmm. Transparent. What do you use those for? They came with the house, so I don't know what to do with them.
Well, like there's over 5,000 cultivars.
Seems like I heard that.
I'm not going to be able to tell you that right off the top of my head.
Okay.
I know of transparent. I know what it looks like, but I don't know what it's good for in mm-hmm. terms of whether it's a fresh eating apple or cooking apple. That's something I'd have to look up because I don't know all the details on what we would call heirloom varieties.
You didn't say anything about cider apples.
Well, you can use any apple for cider, but usually when farmers are making cider, a lot of times it will be a mixture of different apples because some apples have a higher sugar to acid ratio. Some are almost pure sugar. Macintosh, for instance, has a very unique flavor. And so, but when you... go to the fruit and vegetable show in Grand Rapids, usually there are blends that people will use in order to get what they like for their cider.
Okay.
I mean, you could use one cultivar if you wanted. It just depends on what you want.
Any wisdom on harvesting? I've been experimenting a little bit, maybe picking. I used to want to keep my fruit to the last, talking about fruit, but I'm actually talking about tomatoes, mm-hmm. kind of till they were just rosy red and at peak. But I'm sometimes some disease or cracking or various things happen if you let them go on the longer side of ripe.
Well, yeah, especially if you have any breaks in the skin, like concentric or radial growth cracks, then you'll have various fungi will start to grow and cause the tomato to go downhill quite quickly. The way I tell people is when you harvest something earlier, it ships better because it's more firm, it's less likely to have cracks in it, and it will continue to ripen, but you do sacrifice flavor the earlier you ripen something. And depending on what you're harvesting, the quality for processing it may be a little different too. So, for instance, if you wait too long on an apple, they start to become mealy. And even if you wanted to make applesauce, the texture's not quite the same from a mealy apple as it would be from one that was in the ideal range of ripeness. Also, when you harvest, when you allow something to ripen, then the time that you have before you have to do something with it, whether you're processing it or eating it fresh, is much shortened because you're at its peak and it's only one way it's going to go. After that, it's downhill. But you do have the best flavor as you reach the prime ripening time. So you have to decide on what you want to do. If I'm making a fresh salsa and I go out and pick something right in the garden, I'm going to want a tomato that's ripe. But if I'm going to, say, can something, and I'm not going to get to it right away, then I'm going to want something a little less ripe, and that will continue to ripen when I bring it in the house up until I can process it. So it's something you learn over time, depending on how you're going to use your crop.
Yep, every year is an experiment, but I think you kind of fine-tune it as you go by with experience. Kind of an unusual thing, I had a volunteer butter, nut,
squash.
Mm-hmm. And it was in my greenhouse. I've never planted any in my greenhouse. Somehow it showed up. And so I didn't want to cut. It was cutting across the rows. So I ran it up the strings, mm-hmm. and it went up. And then it came down, and then it went up. And I think it's going on its fourth trip around. And literally, I took a picture just in the last 24 hours of my hand. And the height of that is two hands' height, and it has its girth is all of 6 inches, if not seven. Mm-hmm. They're huge, amazing, and they're hanging from the vine halfway up.
There's no problem growing squash that way. It saves space if you want to do the work.
So it's just been an interesting experience. Planning for next year. What should we do in planning for next year's crop?
Well, it depends on what kind of crop we're talking about.
Okay.
Are we talking about flowers? Are we talking about roses? Are we talking about vegetables? Are we talking about fruits?
What? Well, I'm into things I can eat, but take it where you want to, Gary.
Well, one of the things that I want to talk about is roses.
Ah, yes.
And it's not too early to start planning for buying roses for next year. And one of the things I want to do next year is plant a rose garden, but only fragrant roses.
Is there any other? I guess.
Most roses don't have much of a smell.
Oh, that's true.
And when people buy roses that are grown in Chile or someplace like that, they don't have any smell at all because that's not what they bred them for. They bred them for the nice stout stems and the size of the flower and all those sorts of things. And in that process, the genetics that would produce the fragrance is taken out. But one of the things I'm doing is I'm making a video. I'm doing the research and the script on it right now on roses that have won the American Rose Society awards or recognition for being the most fragrant ones. And then I'm going to do one on heirloom roses also. And so I can't mention all 22 because we just don't have time. But I'll just mention a few of them. One is Double Delight, which I think I've mentioned in the past. That one's a hybrid tea, and it's kind of a creamy, whitish yellow with red borders. Mm-hmm. Excellent rose smell. And the thing that most people don't realize is that if you grow fragrant roses and you bring a bunch of them inside the house and you put them in a vase, it fills the room with the fragrance. And people really have not experienced that. You've probably heard of aromatherapy. Mm-hmm. It's just such a calming and enjoyable smell. One of the things that I like to get during Christmas is liquid and hand bar soap that has rose scent in it. And I had gotten one liquid soap, and it was just wonderful to wash your hands with that stuff. And my wife used most of it. I just found out it's almost empty. And I only use it on special occasions. Mm. But when you grow some of these fragrant roses, it's just wonderful. And another one's called Ellie, and it has kind of a citrus spice, and it's a pink blossom. There's one called 4th of July. And I'm not too crazy about how this one looks because it looks like they call it 4th of July because the color kind of explodes out of it in the sense that it's they're single petals, but they're striped red and white. But it does have a wonderful scent. They call it an apple rose scent. And there's another one called Honey Perfume, so that should tell you something right there. And that one's a warm apricot color. There's another one called Memorial Day, and this one's also a hybrid tea, male pink flowers. Mr. Lincoln. Mm. Mr. Lincoln and another one is Crimson Glory. Those are both red, deep red roses. Excellent rose smell. There's another one called Sentimental. And that one is also kind of a striped burgundy with white blooms. And that one has kind of a damask, spicy smell to it. And you really have to learn what they mean by these smells. So when you hear something like damask spice or an apple rose or something like that, then you have to really go to a rose garden and smell them so you can get an idea of what that's like. But there's another one called Fragrant Cloud, for instance, which has kind of a citrusy damask smell to it. And that one is an orange-red bloom. It's a hybrid tea also. Fragrant Plum, if you like lavender ones, and Angel Face. Angel Face is a little lighter lavender than Fragrant Plum, but both of those have kind of a fruity smell to them. So there are lots of different roses, and you'll get all different colors. You could either, say, grow a bunch of Chrysler Imperials, which are deep red, and give your significant person. And by the way, guys do like flowers. I always used to complain as a horticulturist, the only flowers I ever used to get in the office was dead stuff, and they wanted to know what was wrong with it. Yeah. So again, somebody would just bring me a nice flower once in a while. But you might want to try some of these, and you'll be very pleased with how they'll make your house smell. You don't have to go get one of those things that you plug in, you know, the air plug-in things. And although they do smell nice, but they don't smell as nice as a bouquet of roses that just came out of the garden.
Oh, how true.
So you might want to give that a try. And I'm also doing some, I'll be doing some, a series of videos on flower garden design over the winter months.
Oh, that sounds
good. A lot of stuff for next year. And one of the things that I'm going to talk about is fragrant gardens, because there are annuals and perennials that have different fragrances that looking at things is nice, but smelling them is even nicer.
Oh.
Now, that won't include things like Shasta daisies, because they smell like vomit. That's just terrible. But there are some really nice smells out there.
Well, you know, you've done some YouTube videos, and after the break, we'll come back and talk about Gary's newest YouTube videos. We'll be right back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy.
When you're taking a trip, it's important to stay on the right road and to follow the GPS or roadmap to be sure that you get to your destination. Likewise, on your trip to heaven, it is vital to follow the roadmap, the Bible, God's positioning system. To do that, stay with Strong Tower Radio as we uplift the Bible and proclaim God's character. If you'd like to help with this mission, go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on the donate button, or call 231-468-2087. We thank you, and may God bless you as we proclaim God's character together.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Tom Majeure, and Sue Majeure. Gary, we left off leaving a little tantalizing them with your latest YouTube videos. Now, one that's near and dear to my heart is the powdery mildew invasion.
Yeah, I did about two or three videos on diseases. And one was powdery mildew, and I talked about what it was and what it did to the plant. And I primarily talked about organic ways of dealing with it. So it's called the Powdery Mildew Invasion Expert Organic Tips and Advice on Prevention and Treatment.
Well, really, I was very impressed. I don't spend a lot of time on YouTube, and I did watch this one, and it was very informative. You did a nice job.
Yeah, I try to keep them short and to the point, but sometimes when you're trying to explain how different organic products work, it takes a little bit longer. But another one I did, which was more for nature and relaxation, was hummingbirds.
And it's I liked those.
It's just
those
a series
nice.
Of hummingbirds and some nice background music, something that maybe you come home, you've been stressed out, and you just want to hang out and watch something that's not going to get you upset, like a lot of YouTube videos will. And then I did another one on the imported cabbage worm. And also, I mentioned in there other things that could cause similar damage. And then I also did another nature video for relaxation. It was about butterflies.
That was lovely too.
And it was just viewing butterflies with some nice music. Then I did one on Colorado potato beetle and how to manage them. And I also did an attracting butterflies to your garden. So when people are thinking about this next year, when they're planting their gardens, there's some things that you can plant that will actually attract them. And so we talked about that, I think, on the program about a month or so ago. And then I don't know if I mentioned this or not, but I'm doing a series on home orchard management from planning to processing. And I'm working on the second portion right now, and that first one is about a half hour long, so it's quite a bit of information. The second one will probably be just as long, but it'll be a little different because I have done some other videos on some of the things that I'll cover in there, like planting and fertilization and that type of thing. So I will just briefly mention those in the video, and then I'll have a card or an end screen that will take you to those detailed sections when we're talking about cultural things. And then I'll do a whole thing on pest management and spraying and all that sort of stuff. So those are coming, but they take a lot longer to put together. And so those are the videos that are up right now. Feel free to go see them, tell other people about them. And if you have ideas of something you want me to do, just put it in the comments or send me an email. And my email is simple. It's HEILIG@MSU, which stands for Michigan State University, .edu.
And Gary, also, if you you were talking about pesticides, let's talk about organic pesticides.
Well, specifically, we're talking about one type of organic pesticide, and they're what we call biological fungicides. And a biological fungicide, and an example would be Serenade, is usually a beneficial organism. It can be a bacteria or it could be a fungus, and probably it could be a virus too, but you don't see very many viruses out there for homeowner use anyway. And they have different modes of action, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we talk about different ones that are out. And the nice thing about the biological fungicides is many of them are what we call eradicants, which means that once a disease starts to show up, they can destroy it. Mm-hmm. And most fungicides tend to be applied before the problem shows up, and that's called a preventative. And some have both functions. They can eradicate an infection plus prevent further infections. So I mentioned Serenade, and this one is a bacillus bacteria. It's a naturally occurring bacillus bacteria, and there are a number of bacillus bacteria that are used for controlling imported cabbage worm. There's one that's used for mosquitoes and a number of other things. So the way it works is this particular one prevents powdery mildew spores, which are like a seed, from actually infecting the plant. And most of these fungicides have to be applied about every 7 to 10 days because they are living organisms and they don't last forever. So you don't want to get something that's been around for many, many years, because if it's just sitting around at home and exposed to extremes and temperature, it's not going to live as long. And there are a couple of them that you have to use within the same growing season. And you need to read the label to know how long those will last. And the other nice thing about them is they're very specific as to what they do. They have very low toxicity. You can apply them up to the day that you harvest the fruit. And even though you're going to wash off the fruit, even if you consume this, it wouldn't bother you at all. Because
it's good to know.
These fungal spores and bacteria just don't have any effect on you. And we already mentioned Serenade, and there's another one called Actinovate that you can buy. And Actinovate is something that you're going to have to buy online, for instance, on Amazon. And on the the video that I just put up on powdery mildew, if it's on Amazon, I have a direct link in the description if you want to buy it. So you just have to click on that and should take you right to Amazon. But some of the others, for instance, there's another one called Echo Swing. Now, that one you can't find on Amazon. You'd have to go to another website for that. But this one is an extract from a tropical citrus tree. And it does a number of different things, but it acts as a desiccant. Like a desiccant is something that dries out a fungus. And also, it disrupts the cell walls of the fungus. In other words, they fall apart. Mm-hmm. And kills it that way. And it also triggers a response in the plant for it to, they don't have an immune system like we do, but they do have immune responses. And to give you an example, for instance, if you had a bunch of trees along a city block, and many times they'll have root grafts, in other words, they'll be connected together by the roots. And if an insect starts attacking one tree, that tree will not only change its chemical makeup to try to fight that insect, it will also transmit a chemical message to the other trees that it's being attacked, and then they will change their chemical makeup to try to fight off that pest. It's not always successful, but these things happen. So this particular material, Echo Swing, kind of gets the plant to mobilize its structure so that it could try to fight the fungus. There's another one called Regalia CG. It's also a fungicide. It's a bacteria. And it also tends to boost its ability to resist disease. And by doing that, it helps to boost the yield of the plant. So if you want more details on them, you can go on wherever you buy them, and they'll tell you some of this on the label, but usually you have to get something called an MSDS sheet that'll tell you every little thing about a chemical, how fast it breaks down in the environment, and what its half-life is, and its mode of action, in other words, how it works. So an MSDS sheet has to be done on every chemical that is on the market. And so if I wanted an MSDS sheet for Regalia, I just get on a search engine and type that in, Regalia CG MSDS sheet. And it gives you a lot of information that you don't find on the label. It even tells you how fast, what temperature stuff burns at. So it's quite interesting for geeks like me.
let's look at our lawn. We've gone a couple months without intensively looking at our turf. And so many people are concerned about that and are looking for tips and tricks.
Well, some people, especially if they're on lighter soils and they didn't water at all, maybe some areas of their lawn died out and they may want to just take the whole thing out or do some overseeding. And as we've said in the past, mid-August to mid-September is the ideal time. The later you go in the September, the more of a gamble it is because you don't know when the cold weather is going to come. If we have a warm fall, then you'll get away with going later in September and putting your seeds in. But one of the things that you want to do, if you're going to put in a new lawn or even overseed, is to run a soil test to see what nutrients you need to put down so that seed can get off to a good start. You have to also realize that the seed has to be kept moist. If it dries out, especially after it first germinates, it's going to die. You want to be sure that you don't have any grub problems, so you need to check for grubs because, as I said in the past, grubs will eat grass seed. And you want to match up your grass seed to what you have if you're overseeding. Most homes have what's called a mixture, which is Kentucky bluegrasses, fescues, and perennial ryes. If you have turf that was sodded, then you have a blend, which is usually multiple species of Kentucky bluegrass. So that's what you're going to want to overseed with. If you know what the blend is, then you want to try to match it. But otherwise, you might get a little slight difference in shade. And you get what you pay for, so buy the best seed you can afford. And if you're starting from scratch, you want to put down, especially if you're using a mixture, between 3 to 4 pounds of seed per 1,000 square feet. You need good seed to soil contact, so it's a good idea to either work up the soil and rake it, and then when you put your seed down, then roll that, and then put your straw, clean straw, on top of that to keep the moisture there, and it should be watered every day until it germinates. And if you're just doing like patch stuff, you at least want to rough up the soil before you put your soil down there, or your seed down there, because just putting seed on the surface, it doesn't necessarily work its way down to the soil. It might get into the thatch layer, and that's not the best place for it to get a start. And when you're buying seed, you want new seed, and it should tell you packed for 2023. And also look for the seed that has the highest germination percentage and the lowest amount of seeds. It should be less than 1%. We're talking about seeds that you don't want, like weed seeds, because no package of seed is perfect. And it does take a while for it to come up. Kentucky bluegrass can take up to a month to come up. And whereas your perennial rye, which we call it the nurse grass, that's going to be up within about a week if it's watered. And what I always like to do is when I buy a mixture, I'll put extra Kentucky bluegrass in there because I really like the Kentucky bluegrass. So you can do that, but just write down what you put down so then in the future, if you need to do some overseeding, you'll know what you have to go out and get. Now, in terms of moles, moles will do some damage. If you happen to see moles working under your newly seeded grass, because if you're watering it, the earthworms are going to be on this, coming up to the surface, and they're going to be coming through there. Just go over it with your mower, and or if you have like a lawn tractor and a roller, and just roll it down, or just take a roller and partially fill it with water and pull it over that area so that it stays pretty tight. Otherwise, you get air pockets and the seed will die. Don't start mowing until the grass has been established for at least a month. And be sure that your mowing blade is sharp so that you're not ripping the grass out of the soil. And also, if you put down fertilizer before you seed, then if you're going to fertilize later in the year, like say early October or late October, then you want to use something that has slow release nitrogen and also higher levels of potassium. And you don't normally need phosphorus at that point, because if you needed phosphorus, you would have put that down before you put the seed down. So, and then of course, the one thing you want to be sure that you pick the right grass seed for the right location. So if you have shade, you don't want a full sun grass seed mix.
Well, very good. Sue, do you have any final questions for Gary this month?
Well, let's see. I think he covered the turf thing pretty thoroughly. And I can say, since I watched some of those new videos, sounds right, the powdery mildew was very informative, and I really like the hummingbird and butterfly relaxation one. Those were very lovely. I felt quite relaxed.
Well, one of the things that I was doing on my YouTube channel is, you know, there are different playlists. Like, for instance, I have a playlist for pruning, playlist for fruit tree management and those types of things. So I'm going to have a nature playlist. And the whole idea is I want to do some nature stuff where you can just kind of watch it and relax while you're doing something. Like, I like to do that type of thing when I'm folding laundry, or if I'm reading a book and I want some background noise, because if it gets too quiet in the house, it starts to nod off, then I'll put on a slight thunderstorm in the background. And or I might open up multiple YouTube channels, and I'll put, say, Falling Leaves in the Fall and somebody playing the harp. And then I'll balance those so that the harp is quiet enough so it's not disturbing me and you can still hear the leaves in the background. And I found those really relaxing. And it's great for reading or doing little projects or whatever you might be doing. Maybe you're going through maybe going through all your screws and matching them all the sizes up. And I like to do that type of thing. So that's why I'm putting that in there. Or somebody comes home from work and maybe they had a bad day and they just want to watch a video that's going to make them relax. So that's
yeah, we all need those kind of things.
Yeah. So I'm going to be doing some things at the edge of Lake Michigan or whatever the case may be, fall colors or whatever.
Well,
so I'll do some every now and then.
Well, very good. Well, listeners, you've been listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy on Strong Tower Radio. And our host, our technical expert is Gary Heilig and Sue Majeur and her brother, Thomas.
And if anybody ever has a question, they can always email me and I'll cover it on the program if they want. Or you can just send something to Tom or the station here if you want to hear about a particular topic. And we'll get the research done and we'll bring it up on the program.
Very good. Until next time, this is Strong Tower Radio. Bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to Strong Tower Radio Network. Our stations reach from Kalamazoo over to Lansing and up to the Mackinac Bridge and then west to Ironwood on the border of Wisconsin and even a station in central Illinois. Our most southerly station is 97.3 W247 AM Kalamazoo. Driving north on 131, you can tune to 91.9 WMJC in Richland. Continuing north on 131, you can tune to 89.7 WNHG Grand Rapids. Driving west from Grand Rapids, you can tune to 93.1 WMPA Ferrisburg. Driving north from Grand Rapids, you can continue to listen to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 91.9 FM WGCP Cadillac. Driving east from Grand Rapids to Lansing, you can continue listening to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 1540 AM KTGG Okemos and 104.7 W284 AH Lansing, as well as 92.3 W222 CU Charlotte. Driving north from Lansing, you can continue listening to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 90.7 FM WBHL Harrison. Continuing your drive north, you can keep listening to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 93.9 FM WAVC Mayo and 102.7 FM W274BN Alpena. Crossing over the beautiful Mackinac Bridge, you can hear Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 97.9 WIHC Newberry. Driving west of Newberry, Strong Tower Radio can be received by tuning to WUPJ Escanaba on 90.9 FM. Driving further west, tune to 91.3 FM W217CG Ironwood. And lastly, in the heart of the land of Lincoln, tune to Strong Tower Radio on 91.3 FM W217BB Hickory Point. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.